You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Bernie Madoff's name is recognized and vilified around the world, a universal shorthand for a selfish, shameful era, writes Diana B. Henriques, senior financial writer for The New York Times and the first reporter to visit Mr. Madoff in prison. In her book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust, she tells the story not only of Mr. Madoff's nefarious activities and the lives that were devastated by his crimes, but also explains how little has changed in the wake of his Ponzi scheme and how more victims are likely to be lured by the financial magic of Wall Street in the future. It's published by Times Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Diana Henriques to our show today. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Wasn't the book's original title World of Lies? Why was it changed?
It was. We thought that was my personal title, thereby keeping my record of never being allowed to actually put my own title on any of my books. But I was trying to capture that sense of a global Ponzi scheme with this web of lies that stretched around the world. But after I visited Madoff in prison and had that personal experience over that visit, the next several months of emails and letters, and my second visit, we changed the title to The Wizard of Lies because he was clearly so central. He was really the wizard at the center of this web.
You said he hasn't read the book yet, but that he finds the title objectionable. What was he hoping for? Bernie Madoff, nice guy?
I wrote him back. He thought it was sensationalistic, was his reaction when he read about it in the paper. And I said, wrote him back in an email. I said, Bernie, you must have known that any book about you was going to have the word lies in the title somewhere.
Or Ponzi.
So he didn't follow up on that.
Will he be sent a free copy?
He has been sent a copy. The prison actually has very rigid rules about what he can receive through the mail. I could not send him one personally. It had to come from the publisher. I don't even know for sure that they will have allowed it in. So I don't know if he's seen it yet. I don't know if he's read it yet.
Well, it's a thick book, and I'd be afraid of being bopped on the head with it by a prisoner. Listeners have been writing in asking whether there's anything that we haven't already learned about this story.
Oh, I think there is. Actually, I think that the race to cover the news developments, which I was part of at the Times and which a lot of other people in journalism were involved with, made it very hard for us to see the bigger picture. And there is a great deal of new information in this book about how he actually carried out this crime, the elaborate deceptive steps he took, several near-death experiences he had that we had not really understood or known about before. One of them was in 1962, when he was a young man, had just started this firm, had a couple of dozen family members, friends who had entrusted money to him. He had invested it recklessly. He had put it into high-risk stocks he never should have done, and he lost it. And he was there at an intersection where he had to decide, do I admit that I've lost all their money and sacrifice their admiration and my pride, or do I cover it up? And he covered it up.
And once you start doing that, then you get caught up in the game, don't you? Psychologists have talked about this, the pleasure of putting it over on other people.
Either that or a sense of invulnerability to being exposed, which I tried to explore with Madoff in several visits by saying, how did you think this was going to end? You were running a Ponzi scheme. You know, there's three exit strategies. You jump off a bridge, you take tickets to the Seychelles with no extradition treaty, or you wind up in prison. I mean, how did you think? And he went off into this dreamy kind of reflection where he said, well, I knew it was going to end someday, but I kind of thought it would maybe be like 9/11, that actually the world would just kind of stop and there would never be a day of reckoning.
Well, he's 74 years old. How long is his jail sentence?
Well, 150 years.
So it doesn't really – I mean, I'm not saying I'd ever want to spend a minute in jail, but I'd rather spend it when I was older than when I was 25 years old.
I suppose, although he has grandchildren, of course, that he expected to be able to see grow up. And it's not a club-fed kind of prison, Leonard. It's a real medium-security prison, and his days are spent under lock and key. And his not only his mental horizons and his physical activity are greatly curtailed, but his contact with the outside world is highly regimented, too.
He's at the Federal Correctional Complex at Butner, North Carolina.
Yes.
He does seem to be continuing to want to spin the story from his jail cell. And
yes.
Even behind bars, you write, he was a fluent liar. Quote, the magic of his personality is how easy it is to believe him, almost how much you want to believe him.
That was the magic.
He's charismatic?
You know, he isn't. I have covered, at least half a dozen Ponzi schemers, and he is the least charismatic Ponzi schemer I've ever seen. Most of them, I mean, you've seen the coverage. They're bon vivants. They're swashbucklers. They're very charming. Madoff was never the most charming man in the room. He made you feel like you were the most charming man in the room. And that was his gift. He made me feel, as I was interviewing, like I was the most intelligent reporter he'd ever met. My God, this incredible reporter, just amazing. And it's very seductive. It really is. He actually also told me, I'm not Diana. I'm not going to talk to any other reporters but you. I mean, I won't do any interviews until after your book is out. And, for just about this long, I said, oh, thank gosh, that's one less thing for me to worry about. And then I woke up and said, this is a promise being made to you by possibly the largest liar in North America.
And then the articles started appearing, the Financial Times and
absolutely,
elsewhere.
Absolutely, and clearly he had been lying.
Well, didn't you first meet him in the 1990s when you were writing about the reshaping of the American stock market through automation and computerization?
I did.
What was your impression of him at the time?
He was a pleasant, plain-spoken, and accessible man. He was not one of the giants of Wall Street, not a Jamie Dimon or a Lloyd Blankfein like the big investment banks. He was very approachable and very down-to-earth, but he fiercely believed that automation, computerization, and globalization were going to radically change the way we traded stocks, and he was right.
Well, how did he come to head NASDAQ?
He was the non-executive chairman of NASDAQ, and he worked his way up through a variety of industry group committees. Actually, he probably shaped NASDAQ more significantly from behind the scenes than he ever did in that kind of titular position that he had.
And it allowed him to create regulations for the security industry as well,
being
in that position?
It did. He certainly had a voice in how the NASDAQ market was regulated. He had a voice in how U.S. regulation vis-a-vis foreign stocks ought to be carried out. He was a trusted advisor to American regulators for decades.
Was any of his advice self-serving, helping him carry on this Ponzi scheme?
Not that I was able to detect. It was he lived in two parallel universes. He had this legitimate business, and he did lobby the SEC fiercely to get rules passed and to get arrangements made that would benefit that legitimate wholesale stock trading business, which is all I knew he was doing, all most of us knew. Then he had that dark parallel universe where he was managing money through a supposedly secret hedge fund, although it was never constituted that way. His clients were other hedge funds, and hedge funds were really outside the regulatory pale at that time. So he didn't really need to shape the rule book for them. They weren't really covered by the rule book.
My guest is Diana B. Henriquez, who's the author of The White Sharks of Wall Street and Fidelity's World, a senior financial writer for The New York Times. And she joined the staff there in 1989. She's won a Polk Award and several awards for her work on the Times coverage of the Madoff scandal. It was also part of the team that covered the financial crisis of 2008. And now she's written a book called The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. It is published by Times Books. You write that Madoff's Ponzi scheme didn't follow the traditional formula.
It didn't. It's almost a different species of crime, and I think that's what makes it most alarming. The traditional Ponzi scheme promises you gigantic returns, that 50% a month, some enormous amount, get rich quick. Madoff was brilliant in that he did not do that. He didn't promise you the sun, moon, and stars. He just promised you a nice, steady return. He did not exploit people's greed. He exploited their fear. Their fear of increasingly volatile, increasingly complicated, baffling markets. And that fear is still present among investors today. We still feel baffled by the markets. So I fear that we're still very much vulnerable to a soft-spoken Bernie Madoff who will make us feel safe.
It didn't hurt that he had that NASDAQ connection.
Oh,
I suspect that if I met a man who had run or had a major position in NASDAQ and I was told that he was doing better than other people for investors, I might think, well, the man knows the right people. He has the right sources. The same kind of arguments we're hearing right now in the Galyon case.
Well, to some extent, you would have been impressed by his background, of course, that he never claimed that he was trading on inside information or that he had any secret sources about information. Rather, he claimed that he had this very conservative hedged strategy where you could make money or avoid losing money regardless of what happened to markets, which is, of course, the holy grail for all investors.
Now, I'm not going to say my listeners are cynical, but two of them have written in to our comment page with similar thoughts. Let me read these.
Sure.
Tom from Seabright, New Jersey, he called in to ask if Madoff isn't being wrongly used as a diversion from the crimes committed on Wall Street. And then a listener left this on a comment on our show page. Quote, I think there's too much focus on Madoff. While he's definitely a crook, his crime was not relevant to the vast majority of investors. His Ponzi scheme did not cause the financial crisis we're experiencing now. As a matter of fact, the scheme unraveled because of the financial crisis, which resulted from the shenanigans of bigger crooks who not only remained free, but stayed in the position of power to cause more damage.
Well, I don't know what I can say about that. Those are wise observations about the nature of life, the nature of Wall Street. However, if we don't take the time to understand the human dynamic that enables Ponzi schemers, we're going to be vulnerable to them. There have been Ponzi schemers in good times and bad. The crime of robbing Peter to pay Paul is as old as the hills. And if people want to focus instead on the shortcomings of other corners of the financial marketplace, then fine. I don't think it's an either or. I think you have to look at the human dimension too.
But doesn't it also shed light on some of the things that have led to this bigger crisis, like the way the SEC handled him? I mean, there were all sorts of warning signs up. I have spoken to Harry Markopoulos.
As have I.
Who, and he saw right through this, and yet nobody seemed to listen to him, partly perhaps because Harry Markopoulos does come across as a slightly odd person, but that's not a reason to ignore the evidence he presented.
You're absolutely right. And what people fail to understand, it's very easy to make the SEC the villain of the piece here, a very easy thing. But what I've tried to do with The Wizard of Lies is to say, look at how it happened. Because if you don't understand how the SEC became so ineffective, so inept, so understaffed, then it's going to happen again. If you think you can just, say, let's regulate our markets and keep people like Bernie Madoff out, you're crazy. There are not enough cops on the beat to protect us from every single Ponzi schemer.
But still, the big question that hasn't been answered is how did the SEC conduct so many investigations of Madoff's firm and not find any evidence of fraud? It was staring them right in the face.
It wasn't, actually. It was a very well-defended fraud. If you look at the details of how Madoff covered it up, Madoff knew what regulators would look for. He knew what they would expect to find, and he created it. He made sure it was in the files. This is a guy who saved old letterhead stationery so that he could create backdated documents and stick them in the files to be sure they were there. This was a guy who created phony computer screens that made it look like the stocks he had traded for you were safely there in Wall Street's central clearinghouse when it was all just a fake. He was inside Wall Street, so he knew what it would take to fool people, and he made sure you found it. Not to mention which, hedge funds and money managers who ran hedge funds were on the very periphery of the SEC's regulatory mandate.
Was it the same SEC that we have today? Has the SEC learned anything about from this experience, like maybe we should listen to people who come in with tips?
I think they have. Now, I think the jury is going to be out about how lasting these changes are going to be and how well-funded they're going to be. But yes, the SEC has completely changed the way it deals with whistleblowers and tips that come in. It has flattened its management structure so there are more people on cases and fewer people behind desks. It has undertaken an overhaul, probably one of the most significant in its history. Will it be enough? I don't know. One of the big problems it has always had is it hasn't had enough money to hire top flight people. And whether or not that budget commitment will come and go. What I've seen looking at Wall Street history going back 40 or 50, 60 years is when the good times roll, nobody thinks they need to pay anything to the SEC. And then when there's a collapse and there's a crisis and there's a scandal, it's, oh my gosh, where was the SEC?
Although there are people right now pushing in Congress for even less regulation.
There are.
Cutting back on funding for all of these commissions and agencies.
Honestly, I thought that the natural process of human amnesia would be a little slower than that. I really did. It's only been 2.5 years since we confronted this remarkable meltdown, and we are already ignoring or forgetting or detouring around the lessons we ought to be taking from it.
My guest is Diana B. Henriquez, a senior financial writer for The New York Times. Her latest book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust, published by Times Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Diana B. Henriquez, H-E-N-R-I-Q-U-E-S. Her latest book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust. It's published by Times Books. She is a senior financial writer at The New York Times. Did you catch him in any lies during your interviews with him?
Yes.
How many interviews did you do?
I did two. They totaled almost 5 hours, a little over 2 hours each time. And then as he promised, he answered follow-up questions in lengthy letters and emails over the next 4 months. And I did. He persists in insisting that this Ponzi scheme did not begin until 1992.
Which is not true.
I just do not believe it is true. That there is too much credible evidence that it was in place early on. The explanations he offered to me for the cash crises that he had before 1992 just didn't hold water. So, yes. Also, I asked him right up front, who else knew? And even though Frank DiPasquale had already pleaded guilty and was awaiting sentencing, he has not identified a single other co-conspirator as to people who knew what he was doing and what he was carrying.
Although he has hinted that the largest private investor, Jeffrey Picower, might have known.
Yes, he said, how could he not have known?
Which I thought was very coy because their relations were strained?
Yes, and also because Picower was very, very shrewd. Picower was far wealthier than any of us ever realized and made a great fortune apart from his Madoff wealth. Unlike most of the other big Madoff investors, Picower did not entrust everything to Madoff.
But you write in the book that he invested $620 million and then withdrew $7.8 billion before Madoff confessed to his brother and two sons in December 2008.
That's true.
That's an incredible profit.
It is, and a remarkable profit. You know, of course, that his widow has written a check back to the Madoff trustee for $7.2 billion, which is the net fictional profit on those accounts. She denies that Jeffrey had any idea that Madoff was a fraud. And the fact that he did initially invest $600 million lends some credence to that. But what Madoff thinks is that he became suspicious. Having initially invested with Madoff in good faith, he became suspicious over time and started drawing this money out.
He had a heart attack and drowned at 67 in a swimming pool several months after Madoff was arrested.
Yes.
So when his wife did that and gave back that $7.2 billion, does that pretty much clear them of any further problems with the government?
Well, it does. They reached a global settlement with the civil prosecutors, civil U.S. attorneys, and with the trustee. Mr. Picower himself is dead and faces obviously no criminal complications.
But it's family members that we're concerned about. Most people don't believe it's plausible that his sons and his wife didn't know. Now, Ruth forfeited $80 million in assets.
She did.
Is she left with?
She was left with, in her negotiations with the U.S. Attorney's Office, with $2.5 million, but she has not yet reached an agreement with the Madoff trustee in bankruptcy court. So I can't tell you actually how much of that she will ultimately be left to live on. But she did reach an agreement. No criminal charges have ever been brought against Ruth Mark or Andrew. None of them have ever even been notified that they were the subject of a criminal investigation.
And why do you think that is? As I said, it doesn't seem plausible that they weren't aware of something.
I don't see why not. I don't see why it is not plausible that they were unaware of
Was he
of
that
Madoff's
clever
crime.
That he was hiding everything from the people who were working with him every day?
Clearly he was. Clearly he did. There are any number of employees who worked at that firm who now come forward and say, I had no idea he was running a fraud. His brother, his sons were not even partners in the firm. They were at-will employees. Believe me, my starting position was innocent until proven guilty, and I went out and looked to see if there were any evidence I could accumulate that would implicate Ruth, Mark, or Andrew, and I could not find any. Everyone who says, oh, they must have known, I think are simply expressing a degree of anger and rage that is not fact-based.
Well, Irving Picard did sue her, the sons, and other family members for $200 million of victims' money.
Yes, which they had withdrawn from the firm in the form of salary, profits, bonuses over the years. If you read those lawsuits carefully, and remember they are civil lawsuits, they are not criminal charges. If you read them carefully, what Picard says is, well, you should have known. There's absolutely no evidence included in any of that litigation, no emails, no handwritten notes, no anything that actually says they did know.
And Peter, who is Bernie's younger brother, is the subject of an investigation by federal prosecutors in New York, according to court papers in a federal lawsuit by the foundation of U.S. Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey and his children. They're suing Peter for $9 million.
They are. That's one of many lawsuits that Peter faces. But his more principal concern is the fact that he has been notified, as those records show, by the U.S. Attorney's Office that he is the subject of a criminal investigation. But in fairness to him, we should say we're 2.5 years out now and there have been no criminal charges brought against him. He insists that he did not know about this fraud.
How has the family reacted? Does Ruth go and visit him regularly?
Not regularly. She has visited him in prison. His surviving son, Andrew, has not.
He doesn't speak to him anymore?
No, nor did his son Mark before his death, unless you consider his suicide.
Mark committed suicide on December 11th.
Yes.
This the two-year anniversary of the arrest.
Yes.
How did Bernie respond to that? You spoke to him again after his son's suicide.
I was shocked at the change in him, actually, Leonard, from August when I'd seen him. And he's sort of kind of crisp and natty and businesslike and at that time. When I saw him in February, much, much thinner. He actually was rumpled, a button unbuttoned, and a little disheveled, and clearly shattered, but did not want to talk about his son's death. It deflected my questions about that. I think that's the one thing that about this whole scandal that really blindsided Madoff was the attacks on his family. I don't think he foresaw them. I don't think he knew what to do about them. I think he was horrified by them, and he just didn't know how to make it stop.
But I would imagine Ruth was devastated by the suicide. She had talked earlier about standing by her man. Even she said, "If you had a grown child who committed a terrible crime, what would you do? Would you abandon him?" But that might have changed after the suicide.
It was certainly every mother's worst nightmare, of course, to lose a grown child, particularly in such an angry and heartbreaking way. The devastation to the Madoff family continues, and that is certainly one of the most grievous.
It sounds
steps.
Like the sort of thing Arthur Miller would have written as a play.
You know, a lot of reporters dream of writing a novel someday, and they've got one in the bottom desk drawer. I can take that off my bucket list. You know, I didn't have to write a novel. This is like a novel, but all true. The human wreckage, and not just within the Madoff family. Obviously, they attract some of our attention, but the grief and the devastation throughout. The world of people who trusted Bernie Madoff is just
many foundations. Mets fans are suffering.
Yes, I know. Well-intentioned people who hoped for the best and thought they were doing a conservative thing and who were just destroyed by their loss of trust.
My guest is Diana B. Henriquez of The New York Times. Her latest book, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust, published by Times Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. At the second meeting, he accused some of the big banks who had dealt with him of willful blindness. Is that a fair accusation?
It is a disputed accusation, Leonard, and it's going to be one of the most important legal battles that's going to flow out of the Madoff case. Two things are going to emerge in the courts from the Madoff scandal. One of them are going to be decisions that are going to dramatically change how investors who get caught in Ponzi schemes are treated. Those are going to be important to follow. Another is going to be this line of lawsuits the trustee has filed against these gigantic banks. And they are going to define once again, who can you hold responsible? What do you need to prove to hold them responsible? The banks insist they were fooled. They had no idea. Some of the banks were privy to a lot of Madoff's financial activities.
And some hedge funds as well.
Some hedge funds as well. And even now, I mean, in the aftermath of his arrest, I got innumerable messages and calls from people say, oh, I knew that all along. I knew Madoff was a scandal. And I just at one point, at a frayed moment, wanted to just scream back, well, then why didn't you call somebody? Why didn't you blow the whistle? The notion that Madoff's dishonesty was an open secret on the street, I think, is more believed in hindsight than at the time. I think we have to take that with a big grain of salt.
But a lot of people were surprised, the people who took their money out innocently, were surprised that they were going to have to pay it back.
Well, that's how Ponzi scheme litigation works, and that's one of the big battles that's emerging here. What is the fair way to do it? You've got two groups of investors here. One of them put in $1 million and took and got it all back out before the scheme collapsed. Another put in $1 million and never took out a penny. Now, both of them lost all the money they thought they'd made, the fictional profits. But the first group got their principal back and the second group didn't. And the trustee's legal theory is you've got to make that second group whole before you can start talking about how to divvy up the rest.
So they can hold on to their original investment but nothing more?
That is the current state of the law. It's being disputed and fought over. But yes, you get your principal investment back but no more.
And what about the people who lost everything? Did they just have to sue somebody, find somebody, a bank or a hedge fund or
not necessarily. If they lost
Ruth or whatever.
If they lost everything, they are covered by the asset recovery efforts of the trustee. If they have a valid claim against the Madoff estate, then they're in that lineup. But we certainly learn, you touch on an important point, Leonard, that in the immediate aftermath of this scandal, we focused too much on how much did you lose. You know, oh, this person lost $100 million. That person lost $1 billion. This hedge fund lost $3 billion. What mattered is how much you had left at the end of the day. And there were obviously people who had lost billions who were never going to miss any meals. And there were people who had lost a few hundred thousand who had nothing left but the cash in their wallet that night.
How did Madoff manage to handle the protracted liquidity crisis and the SEC investigation of late 2005, early 2006.
That was one of the most interesting cliffhangers I explored in the research for this book. He was almost out of money in November of 2005, and nobody knew it.
People were taking money out, and he wasn't getting enough back in?
Exactly. He had actually redemption demands for $105 million. He had to write a check. Three particular hedge funds who wanted their money, who wanted to take that amount out. And he had $13 million in the bank. If he'd written those checks, they'd have bounced and he would have been exposed as a fraud. He managed to survive that that crisis, and I think that's why he was so arrogant about the 2008 meltdown. I think he thought it was possible he might survive that too because he had survived in 2005. He borrowed money on behalf of the firm, moved money around, managed to hold the scheme together, keep the SEC in the dark until the money from Europe, a whole bunch of new hedge funds that were created and started to be marketed, started to pour money back in.
So why couldn't he keep that sort of thing going? Because eventually he realized that the jig was up.
Well, in 2008, he couldn't keep it going because he didn't have enough cash to ride it out and he couldn't get any more. In 2005, He was able to borrow money in the name of his legitimate firm from banks and use it to save his Ponzi scheme secretly. But in 2008, as you will remember, banks weren't lending to anybody, much less a middling little firm like Bernie Madoff. So he just could not get the money to carry it through.
And you say that by about Thanksgiving of 2008, he was pretty sure he just wasn't going to be able to keep it going.
Well, he would never.
Did he have another plan?
He did not admit even to me that he was forced to stop. That was one of the most shocking things about my visit, my conversation with him. He insists to this day that he wasn't a failure at his fraud. He didn't fail. It has Ponzi scheme. He quit. He could have kept it going. He insisted he had.
Eventually, they all fall apart, don't they?
That's my point. But he said, no. He had sovereign wealth funds who wanted to give him money. He had other rich investors. Some of his older investors were going to give him more money. He was going to be able to ride out the storm again, he told me. But he just was tired of the tap dance. He decided to quit.
At 72. A caller suggests that perhaps the SEC wasn't eager to go after Madoff because he had contributed significantly to both the Democratic and Republican parties.
I don't think that was a factor. The SEC is a largely apolitical agency. And besides, everybody on Wall Street had contributed significantly to both political parties over time. Madoff's gifts, I've looked at them, were nothing that would have won him any accolades or any immunity from investigation. I think it's just simpler and sadder. They trusted him, and they believed his incredibly elaborate deceptions, and it's tantalizing to watch them fail to send the one little letter or make the one little phone call that would have exposed it all.
A couple of other Ponzi schemes have come to light since the Madoff case. Do you think that there are more happening right now?
I can almost guarantee it. It's one of the oldest financial frauds there is. It's a unique financial fraud.
And when something like this happens and Bernie Madoff goes to jail, it doesn't stop the next guy?
I would have thought so. I really would have thought so. But I am seeing now regulators cracking down on Ponzi schemes that began after Madoff was locked up for 150 years. Initially, there were a lot of Ponzi schemes, dozens and dozens of them in 2009 that blew up. I think in part because some investors looked at Madoff and said, maybe I better check out my guy. But those were Ponzi schemes that had begun back in the golden days of giddy, believe everything kind of investing. I wasn't surprised that they were falling apart. But when you see a Ponzi scheme that began in 2009, now falling apart, you would have thought that the Madoff story would have vaccinated people against that kind of wild, credulous belief. But it hasn't. And that really is what worries me. That's why we need to understand how Madoff did this.
Well, is it just a matter of somebody, a rogue Wall Street person doing this sort of thing? Or have we also seen it institutionalized in some cases?
Well, every time I wrote about Bernie Madoff, someone would write me an email saying, well, isn't the whole Social Security system one gigantic Ponzi scheme? I'm not going there.
No, but that isn't true. There's a difference between insurance and a Ponzi scheme. But some of the things that we saw at places like, well, at any number of the big houses,
yes,
that are coming to light today sound to me like something akin to a Ponzi scheme.
Let's be careful in our terms here. There was a great deal of dishonesty going on Wall Street. There was a great deal of misleading information. There was a great deal of opportunistic risk-taking at someone else's expense. There was an enormous amount of selfish indifference to what damage your particular investment strategy
especially
would cause.
In this case, with Madoff, some of his best friends, members of his family, and a lot of these Ponzi schemes hurt people who are really close to you, the people you would suspect nobody would want to hurt.
Who else is going to trust you enough? That's the essence of a Ponzi scheme. We can eliminate Ponzi schemes, and we can create a world that is so devoid of trust that a Ponzi scheme is impossible, but none of us want to live in a world like that. So as long as there is enough trust in the world to facilitate human relationships and modern commerce, there's enough trust in the world to permit a Ponzi scheme.
Although the subtitle of your book is The Death of Trust, you don't really mean trust has died. It's just ailing at the moment.
I think it needs a It needs an analysis. We really need to understand that trust is a two-edged sword. It's something we need for modern commerce, but it's also something that we need to understand the danger of. And that's what I hope people will learn here.
Diana B. Henriquez is a senior financial writer for the New York Times, author of a number of books. This one, The Wizard of Lies, Bernie Madoff and the Death of Trust, published by Times Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.